So this is session number 123, Church Discipline and Historical Overview. So our panelists are Brian Whitney, who is currently studying history and sociology at Weber State with an emphasis in American religious history. He has interned with the Church History Department, the LDS Church History Department, and he is currently working as a research fellow for the Community of Christ in Nauvoo. Our next panelist is Amanda Hendricks-Komodo, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan. Her dissertation explores how Mormon missionary work in the Pacific affected their interactions with indigenous people in the United States. She's received fellowships from numerous organizations, and she currently lives in Michigan with her husband and her daughter Eleanor and cat Benny. And our third panelist is D. Michael Quinn, who many of you are probably familiar with his work, was excommunicated in 1993 and is a prominent historian and has a book coming out next year called The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Business. So before we get started, I'm just going to remind you all to turn off your cell phones. So this is a 60-minute panel, so each panelist will have about 10-15 minutes to speak, after all three of them are finished, then we'll have some time for Q&A. And we will be recording this session. And if you have a question in the Q&A, please use the microphone here. I think we'll go ahead and get started. Thanks for coming to this session.
By various terms and methods, excommunication has been around since ancient times among God's people. The Hebrew Bible and the Book of Mormon both refer to the punishment as physical banishment from the community of believers, whereas the New Testament linked excommunication to social shunning. The Hebrew Bible and Christian New Testament refer to blotting out a person's name from God's book. The Book of Mormon said, quote, their names were blotted out, unquote, whereas the Doctrine and Covenant stated that, quote, their names may be blotted out of the general church record of names, unquote. Both ancient and modern scriptures linked this banishment and excommunication to physical amputation, being cut off. Nonetheless, even the Hebrew Bible, often considered the harsh Old Testament, stated in 2 Samuel 14:14 that God, quote, doth devise means that his banished be not expelled from him, unquote. I love that. And Mormons are not the only ones who have excommunicated intellectuals as troublemakers against faith. Orthodox Jews in northern France issued a harem of excommunication posthumously against Spanish philosopher Moses Maimonides in 1232 of the Common Era. Catholics excommunicated English philosopher William of Ockham in 1328. Calvinist Protestants excommunicated Swiss theologian Thomas Erastus in 1572 for, ironically, arguing that the church should not punish Christians. Catholics excommunicated Spanish novelist Miguel Cervantes in 1587. Catholics excommunicated Italian scientist and philosopher Giordano Bruno in 1600, a week before burning him at the stake. Lutheran Protestants excommunicated German astronomer Johannes Kepler in 1612. Sephardic Jews excommunicated Portuguese philosopher Uriel da Costa in 1618. Sephardic Jews excommunicated Dutch philosopher Baruch de Spinoza in 1656. Catholics excommunicated German physician Franz Joseph Gall in 1817 for his medical views. Catholics excommunicated French theologian Charles Jean Loison in 1869. Catholics excommunicated Colombian novelist Jose Maria Vargas in 1900. Eastern Orthodox Christians excommunicated Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy in 1901. Catholics excommunicated French theologian Alfred Loisy in 1908. Baptist Protestants expelled American theologian Berman Foster in 1909. Presbyterian Protestants expelled American theologian J. Gresham Machen in 1932. Orthodox Jews excommunicated American theologian Mordecai Kaplan in 1945. Methodist Protestants expelled English theologian Walter Gill in 1964. Muslims excommunicated by means of a fatwa British novelist Salman Rushdie in 1989. Catholics excommunicated Sri Lankan theologian Tisabala Surya in 1997, and Catholics excommunicated Australian priest Greg Reynolds in 2013 for advocating the ordination of women, which seems particularly interesting in view of today's recent events in Mormonism. Leaders in all religions of the book have regarded excommunication as God's hammer in the hands of his earthly servants. However, as U.S. President Barack Obama has wisely stated, just because you have a hammer doesn't mean that every problem is a nail. You can see such a philosophy at work in what I call the compassionate evolution of excommunication within Mormonism. One of the earliest examples in 1830s was the excommunication of Mormons who participated in dancing with Gentiles. Luckily for me and hundreds of other BYU students in the 1960s, LDS authorities had long since abandoned that accusation by the time we danced the forbidden twist and stomp at the Steelworkers Union Hall in Orem. No wonder I've always been a union man. One of the reasons for excommunication in the 1840s was refusing to go on a mission. Luckily for young men, since the 19th century, that has ceased to be a reason. One of the reasons for excommunication in Pioneer, Utah from the 1850s to 1890s was gossiping. Luckily for most Mormons, since the 19th century, that has ceased to be a reason. Despite many historical precedents for punishing, quote, conduct unbecoming a member of the church, unquote, church president George Albert Smith told two male BYU students in 1948 just to, quote, live your lives as decently as you can, unquote, after they explained to him that they regarded their sexual relationship as marriage. Despite many historical precedents for punishing apostasy, church president David O. McKay refused to authorize a church court against University of Utah philosopher Sterling McMurrin during the 1950s and 1960s, even though Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith and Apostle Mark E. Peterson repeatedly asked for excommunication of this outspoken disbeliever and critic. Like politics, religion is local. Even if you call disciplinary councils courts of love, they still have two main purposes: punishing an individual and intimidating other Mormons from engaging in disapproved behavior. Local leaders can decide not to convene a disciplinary council, even if advised by general authorities to do so. I fondly remember the example from 1985 to 1988 of my own stake president, Hugh S. West, in Salt Lake City, who told me that he declined to hold a disciplinary council on me for publishing controversial Mormon history, even though General Authority 70, James Paramore, and three apostles counseled him to do so. During that same time period, I was inspired by the decade-long example of Stake President Peter G. Kenner in Northern California, who told me that he would never convene a disciplinary council for any reason, because he regarded personal counseling, long-suffering patience, forgiveness, and if necessary, live and let live tolerance as the examples set by Jesus in the New Testament. Despite the scriptural and historical precedents for excommunication, LDS leaders at all levels can follow the examples of Jesus, of George Albert Smith, of David O. McKay, and of those two local leaders. Thank you.
One of the things that has struck me as I've been listening to the conversations about Kate Kelly's excommunication and the pending disciplinary proceedings against John DeLynn is how limited the historical conversations have been on blogs, podcasts, and newspaper articles. Most conversations about church disciplinary actions have been focused almost entirely on the 20th century. And I should mention that I am partially at fault here as well. The blog post that I wrote with Andrea Radke Moss and Chris Wright for the Juvenile Instructor did not extend beyond the 1960s. And none of the conversations that we've heard have been anywhere near as exhaustive or have shown the sort of deep historical knowledge that Mike Quinn has just provided us. As a result, for the most part, Sonia Johnson and September 6th have become antecedents to recent events, but few people have been able to speak intelligently about how Mormons use church discipline to discuss issues surrounding the family, sexuality, and domesticity in either the 19th century or even the early 20th century. In this presentation, I'm going to focus on issues surrounding marriage and the family in Nauvoo in hopes of providing a wider historical context for Kate Kelly's excommunication and church disciplinary proceedings in general. My presentation is going to be nowhere near as exhaustive as Mike's was. I cannot go back to the Bible as well as he did. What I am going to argue, however, is that tensions over polygamy in the Mormon community in the early 1840s made issues surrounding authority in marriage particularly salient. Although leaders of the church had not yet publicly announced that they were practicing polygamy and would not do so for a decade, rumors about the sexual indiscretions of Joseph Smith and other church leaders were already circulating throughout Nauvoo. The Nauvoo State High Council served as a space for church leaders to try to discredit the rumors of sexual immorality and assert their own commitment to white middle-class understandings of domesticity. They also used the council as a place where they could reassert control of the council over the creation and dissolution of individual marriages and the importance of patriarchal authority within the household. People who had committed adultery, women who refused to follow the advice of their husbands, and members who had failed to obtain legal divorces before remarrying were brought before the Nauvoo State High Council for possible disfellowshipment. It is important to note here that none of these men and women were practicing polygamy at the time of their church discipline. Instead, it was their failure to correctly practice monogamy that had brought them before church authorities. Because I only have 10 or so minutes to present my argument, I'm going to focus on two case studies before coming to the present to draw some conclusions about what they can tell us both about the early church and about our present situation. So for the first case study, on January 17th, 1843, Henry Cook received a notice that he was to appear before the State High Council on charges of, quote, unchristian-like conduct for selling your wife and etc., end quote. When the State High Council interviewed Henry, they discovered that he had initially married a woman named Mary after his first wife had died, leaving him with three children. Their destitute circumstances had kept him from hiring a maid or a housekeeper, and it made it impossible for him to care for his children. It's impossible to know exactly what happened next. The stories that Mary and Henry told in court were not simple recollections of the events that had transpired. Both were trying to convince the court that their marriage needed to be dissolved and could no longer function as a marriage. Henry claimed that Mary had become violent soon after their marriage. According to court records, quote, she was in the habit of traveling about of nights when there was no need of it, and etc., and that she would shamefully misuse his children and set bad examples before them, use very indecent language to them, and etc. Moreover, she boasted that she would, quote, be governed by no man, end quote. In response, he tried to bring her under his control, in his words, whipping her pretty severely. When that failed, he claimed that he had jokingly suggested that he sell her to another husband. Now, I should mention, the practice of wife selling was actually fairly common in 18th and 19th century America. Men, often with the consent and at the request of their wives, would walk into town, into the town square, and offer their wives for sale to the highest bidder. The understanding was that the man who bought her would be her new husband and would relieve the previous spouse of any responsibilities for her. Often, the man who bought the woman for sale was a plant. He had already agreed to marry her. The woman and he often already had a relationship, so it's set up. It's not like he's actually just walking in there and auctioning her off to whoever comes up and sort of agrees to buy her. Mary probably viewed the arrangement in this way. According to Henry's testimony, she saw it, quote, as a bargain. Although the council gave Cook a, quote, very appropriate and severe reprimand for whipping his wife, it was ultimately decided that he had acted as, quote, as well as could be expected under the circumstances, and it was decided that he should be acquitted, end quote. For our second case study, who's actually, this woman is an ancestor of mine, Ada Winchell Clements was brought before the State High Council with her husband, Albert, on January 28, 1843. The two had converted to Mormonism in 1832 when Sidney Rigdon gave Albert a Book of Mormon as he was traveling through upstate New York as an itinerant minister. The following year, they moved to Ohio to be with the church and participated in Zion's Camp. Although not much information exists about their marriage or family, they appear to have been close to Joseph Smith and the leadership of the church, although definitely not members of that leadership. Ada worked in Smith's home, and it was actually her testimony that Marianne Boyce quoted as the source of the rumor that Emma pushed Eliza down the stairs after seeing the latter kiss her husband. She was likely a member of the Nauvoo Relief Society as well. The minutes for April 28, 1842 record that the Relief Society voted whether or not a list of more than 20 names should be admitted to their ranks. Among that list was an A. Clements, likely Ada. The list also included women like Phoebe Woodruff and Emily Partridge. Ada's election to the New Relief Society meant that she was regarded well by other women within Nauvoo. When she appeared before the State High Council, however, she was accused of not being, quote, willing to abide the vice of her husband in temporal matters, end quote. Unlike Henry's wife, however, she agreed ultimately to submit to her husband. The council gave her husband Albert, quote, instruction relative to his duty towards his wife. The two situations remind us of the role that church discipline played in maintaining proper understandings of marriage, domesticity, and the family within early Mormonism. Ada Clements had not directly challenged the authority of Joseph Smith or denounced him as a fallen prophet when she was called before a church court to explain her actions. Instead, she had disobeyed her husband and refused to follow his leadership within their marriage. Likewise, Mary Cook did not see her marriage to a second husband as adultery. In participating in a wife sale, she was participating in a highly ritualized custom that people in Great Britain and the United States had long used to end undesirable or unworkable marriages. The trajectory of her marriage was certainly no more unusual or transgressive than the ones in which Mormon leaders were secretly engaging. Ada and Mary were only two of several cases that were brought before the Nauvoo High State Council. Others were indicted for adultery, for insubordination to their husbands, for seducing women as they were immigrating from Britain to the United States, for gossiping, and for living in bigamy. The State High Council found these relationships troubling for a variety of reasons. What appears to have made Ada and Mary's domestic relations so troubling is that they refused to submit to their husband's authority at a time when rumors were circulating about the practice of polygamy, and that circulation of rumors had made issues surrounding marriage particularly sensitive. In Nauvoo, sex and gossip were part of the language of power. Asserting that an individual was living in adultery or had tried to seduce a young woman was a way of suggesting that he was unfit for public office. Likewise, men who'd been accused of sexual immorality used church discipline to assert their own dedication to white middle-class ideas about domesticity in the family. In other words, many of the Mormon leaders were finding their positions as church leaders under fire, and so therefore to reclaim authority, they used the state high council to try to show that they were indeed upstanding members of the community, that they were committed to sort of ideals of monogamy, and therefore none of these rumors could be true. The State High Council then became a forum for members of the Mormon community to demonstrate their allegiance to public morality, proper deference to authority, and ideals of monogamy. The question is, what can these instances tell us about church discipline today? I want to start off with a caveat. I think it would be a mistake to draw too sure a line between church discipline in the Nauvoo and what Kate experienced a few weeks ago. Mike has already shown us many differences. The institutional structures, historical context, and individual personalities are different. In Nauvoo in the 1840s, for example, there were men secretly practicing polygamy even as they publicly affirmed monogamy and disciplined others for having more than one spouse. As far as I know, no member of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles currently has more than one living spouse. It was also possible for men and women to re-enter the church fairly easily after they were excommunicated or disciplined. There is one instance in the State High Council minutes in which a man appeared before the court asking that he be declared a member of the church in good standing again. His argument? He hadn't even realized that he had been disciplined. The court agreed and reinstated him. The two case studies I've outlined today, however, suggest that church disciplinary proceedings have always been a space where the church defined proper understandings of the family and disciplined those who strayed from them. Descriptions of the disciplinary proceedings of Kate Kelly, Sonia Johnson, and other Mormon dissidents often contain an accusation that such proceedings are an abuse of power, and often the argument seems to be that the early church never would have been this way. I want to say that I fundamentally agree that it's an abuse of power. However, it's important to realize that the church has always used church disciplinary proceedings to discipline the family. Any attempt to change that or to change the way that church discipline functions has to be fully cognizant of that history. If we just begin in the 20th century, we have a pretty limited understanding of what's going on within the church and with what's happened in the past. And I think it's also important to notice that these church disciplinary proceedings against families and against women tend to happen when issues surrounding sexuality are already at play and there seems to be some instability within the wider society. In Nauvoo, the practice of polygamy destabilized traditional ideas about marriage, the family, and sexuality. In the 1960s, the sexual revolution and the development of a youth counterculture led the church to feel as though its way of life was under threat. And in the 2000s, the increasing acceptance of feminism and gay rights has led the church to feel as though it will not be able to defend its position on women and homosexuality much longer without being slandered. In these sorts of tense climates, church disciplinary proceedings become a space in which the church seeks to define what it believes are correct practices concerning the family, domesticity, and the place of women, and what are not. And I think that's what we saw in Nauvoo and what we see again with Kate. Thank you.
Up until about 20 minutes ago, I thought that this was an hour and a half long panel. Come on, it's a Mike Quinn panel. Can't give Mike Quinn 10 minutes. So I prepared for 25, so we're going to fly. Hold on to your wigs and keys. The period that I looked at was early Utah period, 1847 to 1899. My talk is titled simply Mormon Excommunication, subtitled Everything I Know I Stole from Mike Quinn. We all do it, right? What we're going to be looking at real briefly here is some of the general trends of excommunication, particularly as it relates to public shaming. And my primary sources for this that I'm looking at is Deseret News, 1851 onward, Salt Lake Tribune, 1871 onward, as well as some of the other primary source literature from the day. We'll talk briefly about some of the higher profile cases, and then I'll finish with some sociological interpretation of excommunication during this period. William R. Hutchinson argued in the book Diversity in the Religious Pluralistic Ideal that essentially, in order to get along with the United States, you had to start modifying your behavior. And what he talks about here is among the radical communities of the time, the ones that experienced actual persecutions were those like the polygamous Mormons or the free-loving Oneidans upstate New York. One does find an obsession with behavior. Those seen as behaving themselves on the other hand, could hold strongly dissenting beliefs, such as the 19th century Quakers or Unitarians, with little fear of derision and almost no fear of persecution. For even serious misbehaviors, seen as Catholics and Mormons, those with inconvenient habits, such as those of the Jews and the Adventists who celebrated Sabbath on the wrong day, that they tended to gain acceptance insofar as they could see fit to alter their practices. So what I'm arguing here through the rest of this is that as Utah is starting to try to assimilate itself into mainstream society, what you're going to see is an increase of excommunication rhetoric in the public discourse, basically trying to clean house, I guess you can say, in order to seem more American and more upstanding leading up into the beginning of the 20th century. So this is an awfully messy chart, but let me explain this a little bit here. So the dark brown that you see here are actual reports of excommunicated members of the Mormon Church. The light gold color that you see is the Salt Lake Tribune reportings beginning in 1871. The orange that you see is Deseret News reportings, not just reportings of excommunications, but just general discourse surrounding this topic of excommunication. And I think that what we'll look at here is just a couple of parallels and correspondences throughout church history. Now, this does not imply causation. But I think it's interesting when you look at some of the general trends that were happening. We'll begin in September of 1851, which would be down in the far end of the chart, when Brigham Young announces at a special conference in Salt Lake City that excommunication would become the punishment for non-paying of tithing or observance of the word of wisdom. Now, 1856 and 57 is when the Mormon Reformation period happened, leading up into the Utah War period. What I think particularly striking is that the Deseret News during that period actually has a dip. You can see right there in 1856 where they actually decrease their amount of talk about excommunication. I found that interesting. Not sure how to interpret that. In 1863, you see a slight peak during the Morrisite War. In the 1870s, you see an increase of discourse, and corresponding during this time is the rise of the Godbeites and the Liberal Party of Utah. Also, the excommunications of Isaac C. Haight, John D. Lee, and George Wood for their involvement in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. 1877, we see our largest peak on the entire chart. This was very peculiar to me that you see so much public recording of excommunications, as well as huge discourse in the Deseret News. However, the Salt Lake Tribune, very difficult to see there, dips way off during this period. But it's interesting to me because this was the year that Brigham Young died, and you have a transition of power. Not sure how much that relates to it, but again, it might be a cleaning house effect going on there. 1885, you have the enactment of what was called the Idaho Test Oath, which prohibited Mormons from voting. So you see this another peak of discourse in that. 1890, of course, is the famous Manifesto on Plural Marriage. It's fascinating because after this, the rhetoric on excommunication seems to go through the roof as far as the newspapers are concerned, but virtually none that are actual reported excommunications. That doesn't mean it wasn't happening. It just means that they weren't necessarily being reported. So very fascinating to me. In 1896, Utah achieved statehood, virtually zero reports of excommunication during that time. So it makes you start to wonder, perhaps they are starting to try to say, well, we've cleaned house, we're good. All of our members now are good, fine, upstanding American citizens. So their reports of excommunications go down. But the rhetoric is just, again, through the roof during that time. So when I talk about rhetoric, what kind of context are we talking about here? Number one, mostly reporting on other religious groups, Catholic, Anglican, Methodist, etc., and following the excommunications that were happening in their churches, in their religious groups. I initially, when I started reading this, thought, well, perhaps they're just trying to rationalize excommunication, normalize the practice of excommunication. However, it's interesting to me that the Salt Lake Tribune was reporting just as often as the Deseret News in this, and the Deseret News would be seen more as a party loyalist newspaper than the Salt Lake Tribune. So perhaps there's a mixture of trying to normalize the practice as well as trying to show ecclesiastical abuse during this time in various religious traditions. Also clarifying Mormon excommunication policies. I read a number of instances where the church was saying, we do not have legal precedent over our people, we can't take their property, we can't imprison them, but we can shun and excommunicate them from the church for poor behavior. A lot of historical uses of excommunication, also the reports of actual excommunicants in Utah, stake conferences and foreign correspondence talking about the numbers, and it usually wasn't names, it was usually just depicted as 1,200 new converts to the church, 200 were excommunicated, things like that. So not always directly linked to current Mormon events. This is in Deseret News, it's 1869, this is the first talk on excommunication that I read. It says, experience has also proved that opposing or speaking against the priesthood or authority which God has placed in his church to govern it is inevitably followed sooner or later by a loss of faith and by complete apostasy. This is rhetoric that we definitely continue to hear today, that once you start criticizing or opposing priesthood authority, that apostasy is sure to follow. So that's as far back as 1869. This is the first report of an excommunicated member publicly, Robert Granger. His crime was stealing and lying, says the news item. Is typical of all subsequent reports here. What you see here is the name of the excommunicant, where they were, in this case Spanish Fork, also what the charge was, stealing and lying, and then who submitted this. This was George Wilkins, acting bishop, and also the clerk. What I found is that it's very common for bishops and ward clerks and or perhaps high council members to be submitting this to the local newspaper. The only instances where we had all quorum of 12 assigned to it was when it was a general authority who was being excommunicated, which was not commonly reported on. This article in 1878 says that the church, as a living organization, is in many respects analogous to a human system. Each part of the body must be in harmony with the other parts, and that which is not in accord and cannot be brought into affinity with it must be rejected, or the whole will become diseased. In other words, conform or assimilate, or expect to be expelled and rejected. Now remember that this is at the height and the rise of the Liberal Party of Utah. A lot of conversation about the Liberal Party of Utah during this period. The Law of the Church was another short article. I really thought this one spoke volumes in its very short amount of space. The church can have no fellowship with the workers of iniquity. If it did, it would be an evidence of a tendency to corruption. I thought that really explains very well why excommunication is used as a tool, sometimes as preventative maintenance on behalf of the church. Otherwise, it might be seen as having a tendency towards being led by its members as opposed to its hierarchy, or being corrupted is how they would report that. During the later period, I thought that this was fascinating. This is in 1889, heading towards statehood. The question of naturalization among Mormons was a huge discussion point. At this point, Judge Zane, who's a territorial Supreme Court judge, rules that Mormons are unfit to be American citizens for the practice of polygamy, as well as the temple rituals which declare an oath of vengeance against the United States. They were seen as un-American. It was interesting that it was a year after this that the Idaho test method comes about, where if you are a Mormon, you're not permitted to vote in Idaho. So during this period, what you see is large-scale excommunications, sometimes for political maneuvering, excommunicating sometimes an entire ward at a time. And Mike Quinn talks about this in his book, Mormon Origins: Extension of Power. It's fascinating because a lot of these people would be brought back into the church within the subsequent few years after being excommunicated so that they could vote in an Idaho election. And this was something that was authorized by the Quorum of 12 Apostles. Here's the naughty list. This is page one of the naughty list of people who have been reported to be excommunicated. I put in there, so there's about 100 people that identified who were reported in the newspaper. I put in there the name, the date, as well as what their charge was with a little one word. So that's page one. Here's page two of that naughty list. These are people who are not going to be getting Christmas presents from Santa Claus that year. Reasons for excommunication. You can see that by far the largest charge was apostasy. Apostasy is a good generic, general blanket term. Looking into it a little bit further as much as possible, it seems to be mostly related to either a loss of faith or just not getting along with your priesthood leadership. Both be counted as apostasy. Next to that is none stated. In other words, they didn't put anything as far as the reason is concerned. But it's interesting because if you look at some of the terms like unchristian-like conduct, unbecoming conduct, most of those seem to be sexual related. So if you add up unchristian-like conduct, unbecoming conduct, seduction, and adultery, add all those together, and really that would come in second to apostasy if they were all in relationship to sexual deviance. By gender, this surprised me. Far more males were reported than females. 82% of the excommunications that were publicly promoted were male, and only 18% were female. And again, that was a surprise to me, maybe to some of you as well. Talk about just some of the key figures during this time. I think Lyman White is, now Lyman White never lived in Utah, but he was probably the first person to be publicly excommunicated from the during the Utah period from the general authorities. His crime was really not coming to Utah. He had set up the Whiteite colony in Texas, felt that he was supposed to do this, felt that Joseph Smith had commanded him to go to Texas, and he brought about 150 followers with him down there and set up a colony along the Paternalis River. Fantastic book about that, Polygamy on the Paternalis. But Brigham Young told him that the gathering was going to happen in Utah or face excommunication. White essentially responded saying, I'm an apostle just like you are. If you try to excommunicate me, I have every right to excommunicate you as well. The fallout from that was the excommunication from Lyman White from the Utah church standpoint. So he was baptized in 1830 in Ohio, huge major player during Missouri period, led Zion's camp. And then in 1848, excommunicated by Brigham Young. Next on the list, we've got Joseph Morris. I love his hairdo. I think I'm going to try it. Joseph Morris was the founder of what was called the Church of the Firstborn, or Morrisites is how they're typically referred to. Baptized 1856 in England, immigrated to Utah the same year, excommunicated in 1862 by Brigham Young. He proclaimed that Brigham Young was a fraud and that he, Joseph Morris, was the true prophet. He attracted a few followers but ran into difficulties when members of his commune wanted to leave. This was up in near Ogden and were being held against their will. Morris and his group had taken refuge in an abandoned fort on Weber River, not far from Ogden. Morris and his wife and two others were shot and killed on June 15, 1862 by a militia raid reportedly ordered by Brigham Young. Very interesting story. William Wild Bill Hickman, you can see that wild look in his eyes, baptized 1839 in Ohio, excommunicated 1868 by Brigham Young. He was a bodyguard and spy for the Mormon Church for Presidents Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, popularly known as a destroying angel. However, a matter of disagreement among historians is whether he acted more in the church's interests or independently as a bit of a renegade. Hickman obeyed the teaching of polygamy. He was a husband to 10 wives, father to 32, 35 children. During the Utah War of 57 and 58, he rallied with his fellow Mormons and was one of the most effective guerrillas in the hit-and-run attacks that wore down the United States Army as they were approaching. He was later arrested and jailed for murdering a government arms dealer during the war, and his troubles multiplied when he implicated Brigham Young. He was actually excommunicated twice, once for trying to get some money out of Brigham Young for the threat publishing an expose against him, and then second for actually having the expose written and published. So one of the few people that gets the joy of being excommunicated twice by Brigham Young. William Godbey, founder of the Godbeyites, probably one of my favorite excommunicants, baptized 1850 in England, immigrated to Utah in 1851, excommunicated in 1869 by Brigham Young. In 68, Godbey and other Mormon merchants began criticizing the economic demands and policies of Brigham Young in a magazine that he had started, a periodical called Utah Magazine. It eventually became the Salt Lake Tribune, so I like to refer to the Salt Lake Tribune as the Godbeyite Press. So later known as the Godbeyites, Godbey and several other proponents were excommunicated on October 25th, 1869. Godbey wanted to reform the LDS Church. He believed that political reform, namely breaking Brigham Young's control over secular matters in the territory, would spur on religious reform. Thus, in February, Godbey helped found the Liberal Party of Utah to oppose LDS candidates in political elections. The party, however, fell out of his control and became increasingly anti-Mormon instead of reform-minded. The Godbeyite Church and the Church of Zion was organized in 1870 and was aimed at embracing all belief systems. It was known for its mysticism. The church eventually died out in 1880. Amasa Lyman, baptized 1832 in New Hampshire, excommunicated in 1870 by the Quorum of Twelve. He preached a sermon in 1862 in Dundee, Scotland, which denied the reality of the necessity of atonement, and which is a central tenet of the Mormon Church. His speech was overlooked for a number of years, but perhaps a political challenge later on brought him before the Quorum of 12 Apostles to answer for his heresy. And although he confessed his error and apologized, he wrote a letter of apology to the general membership, which was published in the Deseret News. Months later, he began preaching the same type of heresy, and he was stripped of his apostleship October 6, 1867, excommunicated 3 years later. Albert Carrington, my final case here, baptized in 1841 in Wisconsin, excommunicated 1885 by the Council of Twelve. He was an extremely important figure in the early church, the early Utah church. He was the regent chancellor of the University of Deseret, which is now the University of Utah, where we're sitting. He helped to locate the territorial capital to Fillmore, Utah, participated in the Constitutional Convention of 1872 for the proposed statehood of Utah, served as the territorial attorney general, also served as the editor for the Deseret News for 9 years, and presiding authority for four different times over the European missions. He was one of the 12 apostles. He was also a counselor to Brigham Young in 1873. He was a church historian in 1874. President of the Perpetual Emigration Fund in 1873. Well, he came under attack by the Salt Lake Tribune in 1875, and then later in 1884, charged with adultery. And the Council of 12 Apostles and the Mormon Church excommunicated him on the 7th of November, 1885, for lascivious conduct and adultery. A few months later, he suffered paralytic strokes and was bedridden for the last 4 years of his life. He pleaded for clemency during this period, and the Council of 12 Apostles did allow him to be rebaptized November 1st of 1887. He died 2 years later in 1889. So a little bit of a sociological interpretation of what we've discussed here. Dr. Moss, one of my scholarly idols, points out that as a group entrenches into mainstream society, tolerance for marginality and deviance can be expected to decrease. By the time that a congregation reaches the entrenchment stage, it does not need to strive with its mavericks, and it can afford the luxury of sidelining or even formally excommunicating them. Basically, he's arguing that earlier in its formation, Mormonism had a greater tolerance for mavericks or people who could be seen as somewhat deviant. However, as the religion continues to grow from its sect phase into a major religious group, it continues to conform itself to the social norms of American society. It no longer can afford to tolerate those who are seen as deviating from the group. Not only can it afford a few casualties at this point, but it may in fact be necessary to cast off those who it perceives as a threat to its identity. Sociologist Anastasia Sulakala butchered her name. When it comes to analyzing how social outcasts are created, it's acknowledged that their efficient exclusion from mainstream society rests upon a rupturing process, excommunication, liable to draw a clear line between the perpetrator and the rest of the community. Never do the members of a community feel closer to each other than when called to face a common threat to their shared values. This is something that we definitely saw with the World Trade Center of 2001. Americans seemed to forego partisanship for a brief period of time and rally together behind a common enemy. This is also useful in religious groups with the practice of excommunication and social shunning, particularly, I would argue, in the earlier Utah period when your name was often appearing in print, which was at this time the primary form of communication. So not only were you excommunicated from your local congregation, but now all of Utah knows about your excommunication, and so now you're socially shunned as well and become a pariah to society. Now, positivists argue that threats to social harmony are a product of dysfunction, social organization, role and value conflicts, and violation of norms, whereas constructivists argue that threats to social harmony are largely social constructions, and they're determined by the group. Depends on the perception of the collective values and interests, and facing a common threat, whether an internal threat or an external threat, has a galvanizing effect for the rest of the community. And finally, Emile Durkheim, while I disagree with much of Durkheim's underlying assumptions, he makes an interesting observation in regards to the necessity of social deviance. He says, imagine a society of saints, a perfect cloister of exemplary individuals. Crimes will there be unknown, but faults, which appear tolerable to the layman, will create there the same scandal that the ordinary offense does in ordinary consciousness. If, then, the society of saints has the power to judge and punish, it will define these lesser acts as criminal and will treat them as such. A lot of 19th century jargon, essentially what he's saying is that if it wasn't for the larger crimes, such as apostasy or sexual misconduct, that they would find something else, that there is a necessity of creating examples of what you shouldn't be in order for society to know what it should be. So if it wasn't for one crime, it might have been for a lesser charge, but that there's no way of, as a society and as an organization, to escape this, that in order for it to maintain its identity, its social cohesion, and its boundaries to set itself apart from the rest of the world, it has to find the deviant and has to point out the deviant and has to socially shun the deviant. For a society to adapt, it must produce a small but consistent flow of people who are willing to experiment with new ways of living, thinking, and behaving. And then those people must in turn also be dealt with, usually through the means of punishment. In conclusion, excommunications are in form a sacrificial offering. Now, I'm not trying to make martyrs out of those who have been excommunicated, but it's a means of reaffirming group identity by clearly defining boundaries. It is necessary in order to maintain social cohesion. However, although necessary, this purging process is not a positive thing for those who are being excommunicated or cast out. Regardless, social shunning and excommunication is likely going to remain a vital tool for maintaining social uniformity in conservative religious traditions. Mormons are far from alone in this practice. As Dr. Quinn has pointed out, stoning practiced in the ancient times. Catholics have practiced both corporal punishment as well as social shunning. Puritans practiced corporal punishment and casting social deviants from their societies. And even the smaller communal societies, such as the Amish and Mennonites, have practiced casting out, social shunning, and excommunication in order to maintain their social purity. Mormons use it, and in the 19th century, it was as much as a social tool as a political one. And I think that the argument can be made that this is still the case today. Thanks.
We have about 15 minutes for Q&A. If you have something you'd like to ask the panelists, please step forward to the microphone and ask your questions.
So the question was, is expanding on the idea of public shaming, the use of public shaming in conjunction with excommunication. And the example that you brought up of somebody who, who was forced to stand up and admit to the guilt that they had. I'm going to give one other example that's not a religious example to maybe perhaps expand on this. Back in the 19th century, of course, the postal carrier system was a little bit different than it is now. You didn't really have home delivery systems. You had usually went to a post office to collect your mail, and typically it was the recipient that would pay the postage, not the sender that would pay the postage. That would become a tremendous cost and burden on the post office if you never picked up your mail, because that was their income, right? So to motivate people to pick up their mail, if you didn't pick up your mail after a certain period of time, they would publish your name in the newspaper, in a list, to say that this person is too cheap to come pick up their mail. So basically humiliate them into coming and purchasing the mail that's been sent to them. As an aside, Joseph Smith in Nauvoo actually gave himself an exemption to this, he never picked up his mail. But anyway, I think that this is an example of how society, not just religious groups, but society, use the idea of social shaming, public humiliation, in order to create group conformity and expectations of behavior. Now, this is, I would say, more emphasized within religious groups when you talk about being an excommunicated member and either having to stand before a congregation and admit to your sins, your grievous sins, or have those published in the newspaper that everybody reads, right? But I would argue that it's a tool in order to, once again, establish this is the clear boundary, and everybody who is on the outside of this boundary, those are our social lepers and deviants. So in order to create more of a hegemonic behavior system, we're going to point out and publicly shame and embarrass. It's the Scarlet A, right? It's the Scarlet A syndrome. Does that answer your question a little bit? Okay.
I think it's clear that the church is poor without all those great beards that you showed us, Brian.
Is that on?
It's on. Hello. Oh, I just have to get really close. Okay. I couldn't help but think about the Lost Apostles book and the fact that excommunication seems to have been a really, really common thing in the early period of the church. And so I was wondering if that sort of calls into question your trend line that you drew there, where excommunication seemed to be increasing. I mean, I think that the growing population of the church and also the growing length of the newspapers may have something to do with the trend that you observed there. So I'm just wondering if you, how confident you are in that trend, and what would you say about that? Thanks.
So the question was about the trend lines and basically my confidence level. And Christopher, let me make sure I'm understanding you right, that how confident I am that the trend lines that I'm showing really are showing an increase over that period of actual excommunications versus just newspaper rhetorical dialogue. I'm not confident. I would have to do a lot further study to figure out what actual numerical excommunications are looking like versus the publication of excommunications. And I do know that I did come across one article. I didn't present this, but I came across one article as an editorial written back to the Deseret News, shaming them for publishing people's dirty laundry, right, and for airing a private matter publicly, which we still hear to this day. And it does seem that there was this dip of how often they reported excommunications after that period. Now, I'm not saying that the editorial changed their shift, but there is an indication that there might have been some pushback from the general public saying, yeah, we're really not comfortable with this amount of public publicity on excommunications. My guess is, and it's just my guess, is that excommunications probably resumed a steady flow rather than peaked and fell down closer that we get into statehood and closer that we get into the ending of the public practice of plural marriage. But our public discourse on it, I do think, goes down in an effort to try to show a good face, to show a good front. So it's as much of a tool of public shaming and clear boundary drawing as much as it is saying, well, we've gotten through that now, and we're over that period, and now we're all good, right? Now we're good, solid American citizens. That's a theory, and I'd love to explore that theory more.
Yeah. I wonder if you could provide a little insight of what you might think might be going on in the minds of the guys up the church office building. This isn't raising any... Oh, there we go. 20 years ago, when Mike and the September 6th were excommunicated, the blowback was sufficient to... the sense we got was that the church realized they made a mistake because these people were all devout believers, and here they were essentially excommunicated for not bowing the knee to the brethren. So now we're looking at 20 years later, we're looking at another purge on the... not on the horizon, but actually here. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what's happening. Is it just that institutional memories are short? The old guys died off, or the new people are just stupid?
So one of the things that has sort of surprised me about the recent excommunications is the reaction specifically to Kate Kelly, who seems to have positioned herself as a believing member who's only, you know, petitioning the church to do, or the prophets to do their job and pray and prophesy. And one of the things that I've argued and that some other people have argued is that it's actually the sort of specter of Sonia Johnson and women marching on Temple Square and chaining themselves in Seattle that is conditioning the response to Kate Kelly. And so when they see Kate, they see Sonia, and they're reacting as much to Sonia Johnson as they are to Kate. And we always talk about how after the September 6th, there was a large backlash, but the excommunications for the ERA seem to have worked if you're looking at them as a church leader. Although the wider society has accepted feminism, the ERA failed, and we still don't have an equal rights amendment. And so I think we need to look sort of beyond the one moment as far as the September 6th and realize that the record with church discipline has been mixed. It hasn't always led to a blowback, and sometimes you see a retrenchment, as you did in the 1960s, that's decades off, as you did in the 1970s with the ERA.
The memory, the institutional memory of the brethren in the leadership of the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve, which is where all the decisions are really made and then passed down to the 70 and others who implement them, that institutional memory is in large part a living memory, so that the men who are most senior in the Quorum of the Twelve and in the First Presidency, senior in age as well as in the tenure within the general authorities, will be deferred to for their perceptions. And that sometimes also applies to the secretaries of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve. Not always, but sometimes they're also asked for their perceptions of a particular issue. But generally, it relies on the senior brethren. And most of these who can now be relied on for that long-term institutional memory have as a very singular sense of us and them the 1960s. And for them, the radical movement of the 1960s is a defining kind of experience nationally as well as with the church. And there is very much a sense of if we allow things to go too far, then we'll have the SDS burning the ROTC building on the U of U campus, which happened here. And so the sense of a siege mentality is very real for the leadership, and the eldest ones that they can turn to see in their experience the 1960s as defining, and they do not want to allow that kind of foment to occur in Mormonism. So as much as I had thought the internet made this kind of purge, which they deny as a term. But I was wrong, that when they feel that a line has been crossed, and they do think of this institutional memory of the 60s, they will react. And despite claims by local leaders that this is all local, that's part of the requirement when they get orders from church headquarters, that they are to tell everyone who asks outside that it is a local decision that originated with them. So that's my perception of why they do what they have done recently, is that they see a tripwire or a boundary, and they do not want that crossed, and it doesn't take too much to exceed their tolerance for diversity and dissent. I'll just mention, for the benefit of those here, I have copies of my remarks. Anyone who wants a copy, those are available.
Okay, we have about 4 more minutes.
Just back to the public shaming for a minute. I know at least into the 1940s, the excommunications were not only published in newspapers, but also in the Improvement Era, which took it beyond the local community. And then at least into the 1970s, the excommunications were announced over the pulpit, usually during the priesthood session, after the Aaronic priesthood had been dismissed. And I'm wondering if that was stopped, at least in part, because of a fear of lawsuits. Any comments would be appreciated.
I think that's a great observation and thesis topic. I don't have an answer or response to that. Lawsuits may play a role into it, but I also think that we make a cultural shift at some point where this public announcement of and public shaming becomes distasteful to the larger majority of people. It could be very well be a combination of legal concern as well as just how much the society is willing to put up with in public shaming. That's an interesting observation. Don't have a great answer for you.
Yeah, there's been this discussion of shaming along with excommunication, and it seems to me some religious groups use shaming only, don't have to excommunicate, and isn't shaming itself quite effective? And as I observed my LDS friends, and the same sort of thing's gone on in my church, the Community of Christ, many people I've known are really more afraid of what amounts to shaming than they are of excommunication. They don't really expect to go so far afield as to shame, but they self-censor because they don't want to be shamed. And I think that's really enough. And final question is related to that is, on the whole matter of excommunication, why would a Christian church expel anybody from the body of Christ? Isn't that contrary to the Jesus we read about in the New Testament?
Very thought-provoking question, and so Bill and I drove here together to Utah from Lamoni, Iowa, and I got to spend the last 13 hours in the car with him. And we came up with all sorts of fantastic ideas. This is a sticky point, is it? Because it's something that you see practiced as Mike indicated in the earliest traditions. It's something that you see continued throughout history, and the question is that's really the big question. How Christian is it to cast somebody out of the body? And for me, not being a theologian but being more of a sociological thinker, I think that society and identity formation creates the necessity theology seems to take a back step, right, to that practice. I could probably speak for another ramble, at least for another half an hour, but I'm going to let Amanda enlighten us further.
I don't know how much we're going to be enlightened. But I think, I mean, public shaming is always an aspect of it, but that's not all that excommunication does. Excommunication and church discipline is also about defining what the religion does and does not believe, what church members will and will not do, and it's also about who's ultimately going to control the public image of whatever church you're talking about, their belief system, and what the community boundaries are. And so, although public shaming gives you some of that, it's the act of being disciplined that sets those boundaries. And I'm not sure, without the disciplinary aspect, that you would have that same sort of authority on display. I mean, I think that's why they were bringing people to the church disciplinary courts for wife selling. Wife selling at that time was also being criminalized within the United States. And the reason that it was being criminalized is the state was trying to assert its authority over the creation and dissolution of marriage. And so marriages were no longer valid if you had not been married by a state authority, if it had not been registered, and you could not get divorced without the state intervening. And the church is doing, the LDS church is doing the same thing at the same time. It's asserting its control over marriage and saying, we get to decide when you're married and when you're not married. And we get to decide sort of what the proper boundaries of this faith are. And without excommunication, without church disciplinary proceedings, it's much harder to control those boundaries because those people are still seen as members of the faith. Whether or not that's Christian is an entirely different question.
Okay, this is the very last question. So quickly, if you can.
I think I'd like to ask Mike, to what extent has there been an insistence with Kate Kelly on the decision being local compared with you and your colleagues in 1993? I have had the sense that everyone sort of knew that the September 6th were subject to state presidents who were subject to general authorities. Seems to me that the lack of transparency with regard to how the decision is made on such a major issue as we just saw, the lack of transparency, it seems to me troubling, and I wonder if institutional pride is sometimes as appalling as individual pride.
Well, lack of transparency is fundamental to this whole process, and the position of the church is that the whole process is confidential. And to make comments about it aside from what has been officially released is inappropriate, and the leaders won't do it, and that's a circular argument, and it does protect the institution, I think, in many ways far more than it protects the individual who's been disciplined. But that's the argument that is made, and I haven't followed the Kate Kelly statements from local leaders closely, and so I can't comment. My sense was that it was being defended as, or at least stated as, a local action of or local origin, but I can't be certain of that. Others here may know that better than I.